I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to The Functional Nerds. This is going to be episode number 247.
That is Patrick Hester. He's an author, a blogger, and a Hugo Award-winning podcaster for the SF Signal podcast. You can check out his website, atfmb.com, and follow him on Twitter at atfmb. My name is John Anilio. I am a podcaster and a musician and a teacher, and you can check out some of the stuff that I do at johnanilio.com, and you can follow me on Twitter.
You added teacher.
What's that?
You added teacher.
Well, I am. So I'm trying to integrate my life, Patrick. You know, like I've had these sort of separate selves and I'm trying to like bring them into one thing.
I told you years ago, it's too hard to keep all that stuff separate. Why do you think I only have, you know?
I know. Well, that's why I'm doing it now. I'm just like, you know what, man? 41. It's like, trying to become a whole person now.
It's funny that you're combining now when everybody else is splitting. Right. Mm. It's like all these people who had the one Facebook account are now going, no, I'm going to have my personal Facebook account and my author Facebook account.
Yeah, we can actually get into that more because I actually have some interesting things to say about that if it comes up. But let's introduce our guest this week. And that is Matt Kressel. Matt was on the show a million years ago, but he's on again because he's got a new book out. But Matt is a multiple Nebula Award nominated writer and World Fantasy Award nominated editor. His novel, King of Shards, will debut on October 13th. It's an imprint of Resurrection House, Arch Press. And his story, The Meeker and the All-Seeing Eye, was a 2014 Nebula Award nominee for Best Short Story. His story, The Sounds of Old Earth, was a 2013 Nebula Award nominee for Best Short Story. And the story also made the 2013 Locus Recommended Reading List. And you could check out Matt's website, which is matthewkressel.net. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, we were talking about it before the show. So I think if people who sometimes people with podcasts, when they discover a new podcast, they like to go back and listen to some, if not all, of the old episodes. So if you're a fan of Matt's and you're checking out this podcast for the first time, go and look through the archives of the Functional Nerds and you will find one from like 5 years ago, which what was that collection that you were kind of promoting at the time?
So I used to edit a zine called Sybil's Garage. We ran 7 issues, one per year. So it was essentially an anthology. It was kind of built like that towards the end. But it was, in the heyday of the zines, you know, about 10 years ago when like self-publishing really got cheap enough where you could do this easily, I decided with a bunch of people in my writers group to start a zine. So Sybil's Garage was the result of that. And it was a lot of fun. We actually got nominated for a World Fantasy Award for that.
That's sweet. So now the writer's group that you're talking about, that is Altered Fluid. Is that the name of your?
That's correct.
Yeah. Rajan Khanna, who is on the show and is going to be on the show again, mentioned that. So he's a part of that group. Would we know some of the other authors that were a member or are a member of that group?
Sure. I think you would know N.K. Jemisin.
No, nope, sure. Never heard of her. Do you have more names that you could throw out? Come on.
Yeah, of course. Elia Dawn Johnson. Sam J. Miller, E.C. Myers, Eugene Myers, Christine Dykman. She writes as Chris Dykman. Elia Dawn Johnson, Mercurio D. Rivera, Lila Wilde.
So far you haven't named anybody that we know. Nobody. it's ridiculous. It's sad, man. It's actually really sad.
And we've had a lot of people come through the group who aren't in the group anymore. Lee Thomas is a very talented horror writer. Was part of our group way back in the day before he moved out of town. So yeah, it's been a good, strong group for a long time.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, that group is based out of New York. And so obviously a major city like New York is going to, you know, artistic and high achieving artistic people are going to sort of gravitate towards those kind of centers. But I do find it interesting how often or how it seems to happen a lot where when you started that, it's before N.K. Jemisin was N.K. Jemisin, you know, she was probably a member of that group before she really had a tremendous success that she's had of the past bunch of years. So I find it interesting it's almost like a chicken or the egg thing. Is it, did these like-minded people find each other? Did they get a lot better from working with the group? Like, what are your thoughts about that?
I think that one of the main traits of the members of the group is a strong work ethic towards their writing. And you see that in people, they continually improve. You know, we're a workshop, and, you know, a healthy workshop always focuses on positive critique. We're not there to destroy anyone's ego, to tear people down. We're there to, like, you know, not rewrite someone's story, but figure out the best way they can tell their story. I mean, Nora N.K. Jemisin, you know, she brought a lot of talent to the group to begin with. She was always on the ball. You know, as far as my own experience with the group, I think it's improved my writing tremendously, just from having feedback from other people who take their work seriously and, you know, who challenge themselves with their writing.
So, John, that's interesting, because it's one of the criteria that a lot of writers look for. What kind of group is it? Is it just people who are getting together and kind of critiquing? Is there a goal? You will find critique groups that are like, they're focused, laser focused on, you know, we want to get you published, for example. So this will be people who have gone up to that next level, and now they're looking for people who challenge them and help them get so much better so that they can get that first story published. That's kind of cool.
I think it's, you know, always good to be surrounded by people as much as possible who are better at you than something if you're trying to learn.
Yeah, well, they've always said, I've always heard, if you're the best writer in the group, you're in the wrong group.
Yeah, I could see that.
Mm. Yeah, Patrick. So yeah, I know you're in a writing group now. Is that based out of Denver, Patrick, or is it another area in Colorado?
Because we meet in Castle Rock, which is between Denver and Colorado Springs.
Okay.
And we do that because we originally had a mix of people from Colorado Springs in the Denver area. Now it's pretty much me and all these other people from Colorado Springs.
So, okay, so they're doing you a solid by meeting in the middle rather
exactly.
than you having to huff it all the way down. That's cool. Yeah, but it's the same idea, you know, because it is, you know, I mean...
And just to throw it out there, it's all Travis Hierman's fault because he moves to New Zealand.
Ah, well, there you go.
And then it's like, what the hell, Travis? Really? You're just going to up and leave and go with your family to New Zealand instead of staying here and helping and supporting my writing? I mean, priorities, dude. Priorities.
Yeah, that's... You can't really meet in the middle there. You're like way out in the Pacific mm-hmm. at that point. So there you go. All right. Well, you know, very cool. So maybe we can get into that a little bit more, but let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Matt, what's your pick this week?
I really loved, and I read this a few months ago, but I love talking about it. 2312 by Kim Stanley Robinson. Have you read this book?
I have not. I'm familiar with it though, because it was nominated for was it for the Hugo 2 years ago? I believe that was like it was nominated then.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, it was published 300 years before it takes place. So
yeah,
in 2012.
It's let's see, I have it right here. It was published in 2013.
Okay,
right. So yeah, 2 years ago. So. I don't know if you remember this talk a few years ago about optimistic science fiction, Jette DeVries, who used to
yes.
work in InnerZone. And so what I really enjoyed about this book was it's like unbridled optimism. There's so much in this book that talks about, look, we could go out, we could explore the stars. We're still going to have the same human problems that we'll always have, but we can overcome most of the crap that is pulling us down now. And I really enjoyed that. It's a very poetic book. It's a very astounding. His imagination, I was just blown away by it. And I've also read The Martian by Andy Weir. I'm sure
love
everyone's
that book. Love that book.
Yeah. And one of the things about that book, without spoiling it for people who haven't read it, is just very optimistic as well. And I'm really excited to see a movie, because the movie's coming out based on the book. That's just the hero in that book is science. And I think that, you know, instead of a film positing a future world that's dystopian and you know, our future is just polluted and bad, it's positing, like, look, this is what happens when humanity gets together. And nothing wrong with a good dystopian story. I like them. I think a good dystopia can comment on today's world. But I feel in some ways that the market got oversaturated with dystopia. So it's very refreshing to see visions of the future that are positive, because I think we could all use a dose of optimism.
Well, and to throw it out there, and again, not to spoil too much, but there is a moment when the world comes together, right?
Yeah.
And in The Martian, the world comes together. And it's just awesome. It's amazing.
Yes.
So I get what you're saying. It's like I've always felt like, you know, Star Trek, the original series, was all about putting forth that even though we go through all this crap, we survive and we come out the other end and we're this peaceful planet and we're getting along with each other. And then we go out into space and find other people to fight.
Yeah. and with your point about the Martian, you know, you're saying like, oh, everyone read it. That is one of those books where I read it a few months ago. And, you know, you get a chapter and you're like, this is why everybody has read this book, because it's great. And it's, you know, it's one of those ones, like, it deserves every bit of notoriety that it has. So, mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to going to see the movie, too. For me this week, I'm going to pick I've been reading a lot of nonfiction lately. And the recent one that I just finished is by a author and a psychologist. I'm going to have to send Patrick the spelling of it, because I believe it's an Eastern European name. But I think you pronounce it Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. It's like C-S-I-K-S-Z. There's a lot of consonants in it. But the book he wrote is called Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. And a lot of I kind of got to this book through a couple of other books I read. I read a book called Reality is Broken by Jane McGonigal, which is all about sort of having gameful issues. Works in the video game industry, and sort of how to make parts of your life more game-like in terms of being more invested in it. And she talked a lot about this Flow book, and it had a big impact on me in the way I'm kind of treating things now, because the basic tenet of the book is people who are happier and more fulfilled tend to have more flow experiences, meaning they become so invested in whatever they're doing that time sort of stops, that, you know, and I think a lot of people, I'm sure Matt and Patrick and a lot of our listeners, if you're a writer and you do that thing where you sit down to write and then you look at the clock and it's 3 hours later, that's a flow experience, because you're deeply invested in what you're doing. And people who tend to have these experiences more frequently are happier, are more fulfilled. And it's something that I was looking into, because I was not experiencing that over the past couple of years. And what I'm doing, obviously, is I'm focusing on doing certain kinds of musical activities more, because that's a place where I can get into more of a flow state. So if you're a creative person or someone that just wants to kind of get into maybe helping yourself be a little happier and not like a woo-woo kind of way, this is like very, you know, there's a lot of like scientific studies on how to achieve this. So yeah, it's called Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience, and it's Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. And look in the show notes for how to spell that, because it's nothing like what it sounds like. Patrick, what's your pick this week?
Well, I'm going a different direction as usual. So the fall TV season, for those of us who aren't cord cut yet, has mm-hmm. begun, and mm-hmm. One of the shows that I watched, I never saw the movie that it's based on, but I've had it in my Netflix queue like probably 5 times. You know, it comes and goes and back and forth and kind of stuff. But I've never watched it, but I've always had it in my queue just so I know that if I want to watch it, I can.
Of course, yeah.
And they made a show about it, and it's on CBS, I believe, and it's called Limitless. And the premise is that there's this drug that when you take the drug, it opens up your brain, and you're using like 100% of your brain, and you can do all this stuff. And the movie had Bradley Cooper mm-hmm. in it. And the TV show is about a guy who's sort of like a slacker. Well, not sort of. I mean, he is. He hasn't done anything really with his life. He's in his probably late 20s and is still doesn't have a job. He's constantly telling his family, you know, well, he's got a band and he's a musician and they're going to release an album soon and people want to hear the music, and then he doesn't have anything that he can really show them. And he's like, well, it's not ready yet. You know, he's that guy. And he comes, you know, he's doing temp jobs and he gets this temp job and he comes across a guy that he used to know who's like, I can't believe you're doing this. And he's like, what are you doing? Oh, you know, I'm a banker kind of guy, and he's rich and he's making all this money and he's doing all this stuff. And he's like, here, try this. And he gives him this pill and he takes it. And his dad, who is essentially dying and no one knows why, he gets super smart and he's able to use every part of his body. And he does all this research and he figures out exactly what's killing his dad. And then he wakes up the next morning with massive withdrawal pains and all these problems. And he just wants another pill. Well, the drug is, number one, illegal. And he doesn't know where else to get it except the guy who gave it to him. And when he goes to get more, that guy's dead. He's been murdered. And someone has stolen all his pills. And then he gets pulled into this whole thing. So it was really interesting. I also find it interesting that they always have to do like police procedurals now. So it's a little bit of science fiction, but what they end up doing is he's like recruited by the FBI because he can take the pill and it doesn't kill him, right? So other people take the pill and it kills them. So there's something about his brain chemistry that makes him super special. He can actually take the pill. And so immediately the FBI is like, hey, he could take the pill. Let's just keep giving him pills and have him solve crimes for us.
Yeah, it's the movie was very good. I remember watching it a few years ago, and you're right, it does. It's one of those ones that like goes in and out of Netflix all the time. Mm-hmm. On Tor or IO9, they were saying that that's kind of the only new genre show that aired this week that's kind of worth watching. Some of the other ones that were like, eh. But I'm definitely curious to check that out. And to sort of piggyback on what you said, the movie was very good. The soundtrack to that movie is excellent,
is
too.
It? Okay.
Yeah, it's by Paul Leonard Morgan. It's on Apple Music and it's on Spotify. It's very electronic kind of, you know, textures and stuff, but it's very good. If you like sort of electronic soundtrack music, as I know a lot of our writer listeners like to sort of have that on in the background while they're writing, check that out. So yeah, if you just put Limitless into Apple Music or Spotify, you'll find it. It's by Paul Leonard Morgan. So there you go there.
But it was an interesting show, and it has Dexter's sister in it. She's the FBI agent. Mm-hmm. I started to give a spoiler about Dexter and I changed my mind.
Yeah,
she was in it and it was interesting. And actually Bradley Cooper does appear in the show.
Cool.
I doubt he'll be a recurring character, but he does appear in the show, which was interesting.
Cool. Cool.
And I remember when he was the nerdy best friend in Alias.
Yes, of course. Yeah. He was great in that. And great as the Rocket Raccoon. Did a great job with that voice. It wasn't like, Bradley Cooper doing a raccoon voice. He really did a very good performance of that, I thought. So
fine. Yeah. I'm standing up. Are you all happy now? We're all a bunch of assholes standing in a circle.
All right. Well, you know, I want to. Matt's publicist was nice enough to send me an advanced reader copy of his book, which by the time you listen to this, I think it'll be out in a few days after it. And it's called The King of Shards. And I'm about 7 or 8 chapters into it already, really enjoying it. And the first couple of things that I've noticed about the book, the first thing, Matt, that I wanted to ask you about was it seems like a very original take on and I think you could classify this as being somewhat of a portal fantasy. And I don't know if you would characterize it that way. And if so, what are some of the portal fantasies that you've read that, you know, had an impact on you, whether an influence on wanting to write a book like this or just something from your past that, you know, sort of impacted you as a reader and a writer?
That's a good question. Specific portal fantasies. I mean, I think the one that comes most strongly to mind, and I don't know if you might consider this a portal fantasy or not, is just the whole Doctor Who universe. Here comes this guy with a box that just comes and whisks you away to another universe. Mm-hmm. And I've also, I grew up reading a lot of H.P. Lovecraft. Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of ways, whether or not you'd classify those as portal stories, it's the otherworldly or supernatural breaking into our world. I think, but the thing that influenced me the most was just looking into these ancient myths and just finding really great ideas for fantasy stories. You know, this idea that I play with in the book that that our universe is not the first universe to be created, that there were other universes and they were smashed, that God thought that they weren't good enough, so he destroyed them. And my thought was, well, what if they weren't empty? What if there were beings in them and they survived this? They were clinging to these fragments of universes and struggling to live. And what would they want? And what would they need? And so these became demons in my book, and these fragments became what I call the shards in the book. So it's actually based on a myth created by or elaborated by, depending on your beliefs, by Rabbi Isaac Luria of the 16th century, who was this mystical rabbi that lived in, you know, in Safed. So it was really cool looking into this stuff, and some of it is taken directly from these myths, and some of it I elaborated on and filled in the blanks and kind of imagined or interpolated, what went on between the lines of the myth.
Yeah. Now, so when you're talking about these myths, and that was, you know, something that struck me as well, in early on in the book, the, a couple of the characters are at a wedding and getting married, and it's a Jewish ceremony. And so, you know, we're talking about this in terms of myth, but I mean, so where are you drawing some of this from in terms of, are these from specific, or like if someone who is, maybe studying Hebrew reading the books, where do these stories come from? Are these sort of well-known stories? Do you have to dig deep in sort of more esoteric texts to find them?
A lot of these stories come from so-called apocryphal tales. These are more of folklore, tales that, mothers might tell their children to scare them, behave or Lilith will get you. Or, everyone's probably heard the story of the golem that the rabbi in Prague fashioned a man of clay and put a holy name on his forehead, or in some cases, I think it was under his armpit.
And one, there was a strip of paper in his mouth.
In his mouth, excuse me, that's what it is. And this animated the man of clay to protect the Jewish section of town from people who wanted to commit a pogrom or go, basically murder all the locals. So everyone knows that tale, but there are all these other tales, as tales of Dybbuks, which are like possessing spirits that would possess brides to be. There's these tales like the origin story of Lilith, who is Adam's first wife. One of my favorite apocryphal tales is the story of the Shamir worm. So the idea is like there's a biblical prohibition against using tools of war to build the ancient temple. So the rabbis are like, well, how did they build this if they didn't use iron? So the myth of the Shamir worm arose, and it's essentially this tiny little worm that you put it onto rock and it will split that rock open. And then from that myth came another myth. It's like, well, how did they find the worm? Oh, well, King Solomon used his magic ring to capture some demons and ask them where he could find that little worm. And so there's like these adventure stories of these demons going off into the desert with some of Solomon's men to go find the Shamir worm. And it's like, so basically it's like, you go down this rabbit hole, so to speak. So you start learning about one myth, which leads to another myth, which leads to another myth. And it's just, you see how these stories and these ideas developed over time into this, it's not just one universe, it's thousands of universes. And I thought, wouldn't it be really cool to write a book that plays with some of these stories? And especially what was interesting to me was trying to take the point of view of one of these demons. There's in one of the stories, Ashmedai, the king of the demons, is going with one of Solomon's men across the desert, and they pass a wedding, and Ashmedai starts crying, and the man says to Ashmedai, "Why are you crying?" And he's like, "Well, you know, there's new shoes laid out for the man to be married, and he's never going to wear them. He's going to die tomorrow before the wedding." And I thought, wow, that's really interesting, because like most of our modern conceptions of demons are like these purely evil, thoughtless, just like, you know, destructive forces. And here's a demon who weeps for a man who's not going to be married. So I was like, wow, I'd really like to take the point of view of that character and play with that and see if I can actually make that character sympathetic. So that's Ashmedai is one of the main characters in the book.
Cool. Yeah. One of the, you know, and it might not be related, and this may be like a horribly naive question. My wife is Jewish, and when we got married 12 years ago now, we had an interfaith wedding. I'm not religious. My wife's not particularly religious either, but we did that because we thought it would be kind of a good thing for the family. So we had a priest and a rabbi, mm-hmm. and I broke the glass, as is traditional. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was thinking about that when I was just looking at the title of your book with the shards, because thinking of like shards of glass. And I know, I mean, from what I understood about breaking the glass, it's, you know, for every piece, every shard of glass, that's supposed to be like a year of happy marriage. But is there other sorts of deeper, you know, symbolism with the shards of glass there that has some sort of relation? I hope I'm not spoiling anything in your book. Or
no, I mean, scene happens in the first chapter, so I don't think you're saying much. There are other interpretations of that. One that I've read is that the sound of the breaking glass scares away demons. There's a lot of myths of like trying to distract or bribe demons so that they don't bother you. So that's like you step on the glass, it scares away demons. The other interpretation I've heard is that there's going back to this idea of the early shattered universes, that these fragments of these universes, these sparks, so to speak, are scattered throughout creation. And it's our job as human beings to lift these sparks by doing righteous acts, kind acts, and this like increases the holiness in the world, raises these sparks. It's in Hebrew they call it tikkun olam, which means repairing the world. So there's this notion that like stepping on the glass and shattering it reminds us of this primordial shattering and our duty to lift these sparks back to holiness. So I mean, the primary one though, I think, is actually to scare off demons. But you know, because most I would say, you know, the at least within the Jewish communities that I grew up in, which was a conservative one, there was not an emphasis on any of mysticism at all. Mm-hmm. It was very much like, these are the rituals you do. Yeah, we'll talk about the mysticism, but we don't believe any of that mysticism stuff. It's just, we just do the ritual. So like, you wouldn't really say we're scaring away demons. Mm-hmm. But among like certain Hasidic communities, I think there is definitely a belief that that is still the case.
Mm-hmm. Right. But what about the stuff like when you talk about there wasn't that much mysticism, you know, all the plays by, oh, what's his name? Was it Neil?
Neil Simon?
Neil Simon?
Yeah. Where he talks about growing up in Jewish communities. And, you know, he kind of emphasizes things that like if someone had cancer, you wouldn't say, oh, they died of cancer. You'd say, oh, they died of cancer, because they don't want to call the cancer to them.
Yeah. Well, among the speakers of Yiddish, which was the primary language of Jews for 1,000 years, that they wouldn't, like, you would actually say bad things about the children if you love them, because if you said good things, it would invite the evil eye. So, so people would say, oh, you're so ugly. My grandchildren are so ugly. They're so meuse. It was ugly, you know, but they don't want to say she's so beautiful, because that would invite misfortune. So there's a lot of superstition built into
sure.
the Yiddish culture. And I think a lot of that was lost when these communities Americanized.
What always fascinates me is when you start talking about this kind of mythology, right? The stuff that doesn't necessarily make it into the Torah or the Bible or any of that. You know, this is the extra stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But if you start going through it, and even the things you've been talking about, I start to see where they fed into science fiction, right?
The
worm out in the desert, the magic ring, you know, the eye.
One of the most famous ways is Spock's gesture.
Oh, yes.
It was the old priestly blessing. And, you know, there's a famous tale that Leonard Nimoy, when he was a kid, his father goes, "Don't look when they do the blessing." And of course he looks and he sees that they're doing basically the Spock gesture with two hands.
Yep.
He was forever fascinated with that. So when it came time in the script to come up with a greeting that Spock would say upon meeting another one of his Vulcans, he said, we need to use something. How about this? How about the Vulcan? How about this gesture? And so that's like no one way of how it actually entered science fiction, which is pretty cool.
Oh, you know what? Just because you brought, and I'm not super into Star Trek, but I saw online, I think it was a week or two ago, I forget where I saw it, but they had a photograph, and it was from, I believe, like 1976. So it's after, you know, after Star Trek, the original series is over. But it was when the space shuttle, and I guess they had a space shuttle Enterprise at the time.
First one. I actually posted that picture.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I saw there. Yeah, I probably saw you posting it. So it's so awesome because it's they're all in, they're all 70s out, man. It's great. It's like, it's the original Star Trek cast, but they're probably all like relatively young. They're probably all in their like early 30s
except,
or something.
Except for Divorce Kelly and James Doohan. Yes. And Shatner wasn't there.
Yeah. I didn't see Shatner there, but it's so great to see them, you know, in their 70s duds, because they're wearing suits, but they're wearing very like 70s suits, you know, no tie and the big collar and big belts and stuff. And then all the NASA guys are all wearing like gray suits that would be fine now or fine in 1952. But it's, I loved it. Thanks for posting that, Patrick, because I really got a kick out of that.
Well,
the
story was, John, when it was announced that NASA was doing this shuttle program, fans of Star Trek really, really went after NASA and petitioned that the first one has to be called Enterprise. It has to be called Enterprise. And there was some hemming and hawing, but eventually that is what happened. So the very first shuttle was Enterprise.
Yeah. No, it was so, so cool. I really love that. But yeah, you know, Matt, one of the other things I wanted to ask, because we can like kind of keep going down that hole with all of the mythology and everything, but you know, you've done a lot of short stories too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you came up with this, with King of Shards, did this start as a short story idea? Like, were you writing it as a short story? Did you know right from the get-go that it was going to be a longer tale?
Well, a few of my stories actually loosely take place in this world. Mm-hmm. The Bricks of Galachek, which is in Ellen Datlow's Naked City anthology. And I've had two stories on Beneath Ceaseless Skies, The Suffering Gallery, and Feth's Aviary also sort of take place in this world. So when I sat down to write King of Shards, I wanted to kind of elaborate on some of these worlds I had been playing with. And I essentially built out the universe. The novel itself didn't come from any particular story, though.
Cool. Now let's, you know, we're about out of time. So let's start to wrap it up a bit. So once again, the book is King of Shards. It will be out, I believe, October 13th is the tentative on sale date that's on this this arc that I have here. So go to your bookstores. I'm sure it will be on Amazon and all that good stuff as well. Do you know if there's going to be an audiobook for it at the time, or is that later on down the line?
There will be an Audible audiobook, and there'll also be an ebook available as well. So
do you know who's doing the narration of it yet?
His name is Jonathan. I forget his last name.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I love, you know, because Patrick and I are a big fan. Patrick's a big Audible fan. I really love doing the, and it's not for every book, but I love doing the whisper sync between the ebook and the audiobook. That's my preferred way to ingest, especially if it's like a big 600 or 700 page sucker, because then that way I'm always kind of invested in it, because like I'm listening in the car. Because sometimes if you have like one of those big books and maybe you have a busy day and you don't get much time to read, it takes you a while to get back into it. But if you can kind of go back and forth where you're never really out of the story, It's great. So hopefully that'll be the case with yours too. It's King of Shards. Everyone should check that out. Matt's website is matthewkressel.net. And what's your Twitter handle, Matt?
It's at Matt Kressel, MattKressel.
Awesome. Good. Now, do you have any, are you going to be doing any con appearances or anything like that coming up?
Yeah, I'll be at World Fantasy. I'm planning on doing a couple of other cons in early 2016 and doing a few readings around the New York City area, et cetera. So it's all on my website.
Where's World Fantasy?
It's in Saratoga Springs, New York.
Okay.
That's upstate New York. I know Rob Bedford and I were playing around with the idea of going because it's not too far from where we are. It's one of those things.
It's a fantastic convention, even if you just show up and hang out at the bar.
I love it. Yeah. And it's a lot of good people going this year too. So if you're a fan and you're in the general area, it's probably worth going to, although it may be sold out at this point too, because that's the one thing with World Fantasy they cap it,
there is a waiting list right now.
So get on that waiting list if you're interested in that.
So the last question, John, is what kind of guitar is that behind you, Matt?
Oh, that's a classical style guitar. I have a regular acoustic and an electric in the closet, but this one, it's like in between. If I get stuck on something when I'm writing, I'll pick it up and pluck it for a little bit.
Mm. Nice. You know, I can't believe I brought it. I forgot to bring it up because even in the first 7 or 8 chapters, I'm like, oh, Matt knows music because he's describing music like the right way. Because sometimes authors will like do a little music stuff, and I'm like, they really shouldn't have used that term. They meant dynamics, but they talked about it with terms that are for tempo, and they meant or something like that. And Matt knew what he was talking about, and he has some nice metaphors and some other stuff in there too. So I meant to bring that up. Next time we have you on, we'll have to talk a little more music.
All right.
Cool. All right. So that's Matt's stuff there for me. Just check me out on Twitter at johnanilio.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at johnanilio. Oh, I should also mention that Patrick and I have a Patreon for the Functional Nerds. So we'll probably have a link to that on the website, but I believe it's just patreon.com/functionalnerds if you'd like to help support us doing this podcast every week. So go and check that out as well. Patrick.
Not only that, I will be at Mile High Con October 23rd to the 25th. I am going to be on panels. I'm also one of the co-hosts of the Writer's Mixer, which is Friday night, starts at 9 p.m. In the bar area, and runs until they kick us out and we're not allowed to be there anymore. So if you are in the Colorado area, even if you don't want to purchase a ticket for Mile High Con, which I still encourage you to do because it's a great con, and you're a writer and you want to come meet and network with other writers and editors and all that kind of good stuff, come to Mile High Con on Friday night, 9 p.m. in the bar.
Sweet. All right, everybody. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for having me on.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?